to the Pacific, across the islands of the Caribbean, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos. We're pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here.
If you are elected and you learned that the government knew aliens had visited Earth and the public didn't know, would you want the public, would you sure the public found out?
Well, it depends on what these aliens were like, and whether they were Democrats or Republicans.
How funny is that, my friends? And you'll see how that applies to what we are going to discuss this hour of the show. And indeed, what a twisted rabbit hole we're going to go down, because today, April 5th, is indeed the 81st anniversary of the signing of Executive Order 6102. It was signed April 5th, 1933, by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, quote, forbidding the hoarding of gold coins, gold bullion, and gold certificates within the continental United States, end quote. This order criminalized the possession of monetary gold by any individual, partnership, association, or corporation. When this was signed, it required all persons to deliver on or before May 1st, 1933, all but a small amount of these gold coins or bullion or certificates owned by them to the Federal Reserve in exchange for $20.67 per troy ounce. Now, in today's money, that would be the equivalent of about $376.58. And, of course, now the price of gold has gone up almost $1,000. So that shows you how dramatically it has risen. And this was, of course, a big deal. A lot of people were very angry about this at the time. It's still a controversial topic. But basically, if you violated the order in 1933, it was punishable by a fine of up to $10,000 or up to 10 years in prison or both. And mind you, back in 1933, $10,000 was equivalent to $182,185. Most citizens who owned large amounts of gold had it transferred to other countries, such as Switzerland. So this, of course, was in effect all the way up until some later presidents made some changes. Like, for example, Richard Nixon. And then finally they legalized various gold certificates. The limitation on gold ownership in the U.S. was repealed after President Gerald Ford signed a bill to permit United States citizens to purchase, hold, sell, or otherwise deal with gold in the United States and abroad. This is interesting as just a footnote in history that sort of applies to today, because this whole idea of finances and the value of the dollar, it becomes complex, especially the way it's often presented in the media. But essentially, as most of you probably know, technically, the U.S. dollar is really based on nothing if you consider the senior bankers are able to simply type an extra digit onto a computer screen to create a dollar. And therefore, we don't have some type of a direct relationship to gold or silver determining the value of the dollar here in the U.S. Now, of course, if you want to look at this realistically, however, because the world economy functions around petroleum products, most economists would tell you that if you're going to look at a realistic gauge of what the dollar is worth, it's based upon what they sort of call a petrodollar, which is really about the ability that the United States military has to persuade other countries to accept the U.S. dollar because they give those countries incentive to do business with us and our petroleum by sending out the military to protect the trade routes and to allow some of these other countries to have access to our planes and munitions and other things that other militaries would like to have. So there is a connection there. But now recently in the news, you've heard about these sanctions that the Obama administration has been placing on Russia over this Ukraine situation. And the fact of the matter is, Russia and their allies like China, they have an enormous amount of gold. In fact, a lot of the gold that disappeared from the United States ended up in the hands of these other countries. And now that the U.S. is playing this sort of financial game with sanctions, countries like, for example, Russia, are trying to enhance their own currency, like the Russian ruble, which is now going to go back to including a gold standard to some extent. So what this ultimately means is that we can predict there is a very good chance that in the near future, the value of the American dollar is actually going to start going down, and the value of gold is going to start going up, which is good news for people like Ms. Shelley Wright of Wright's Coin Shop and all the rest of you who have been wise enough to purchase some gold coins or some silver coins. And, of course, it's not too late to do it because, you know, even right now, a silver eagle's about what, worth around $20, $25, Shelley, something like that?
Something like that, $20, $25, $26, $27, something okay. Like that.
So, you know, it's a very good time still to collect these precious metals, especially if we see that some of these other countries are going to be incorporating that into their systems of finance. But if you have any doubt that there is some kind of a major change that appears to be happening right now in finances, it may have a connection to a lot of these bankers that are committing suicide around the world. Many of them are related to J.P. Morgan. Just this year, at least 8 of the world's major bankers have committed suicide. The latest one was a 28-year-old Manhattan investment banker who jumped to his death from a tall building in New York. Many, many others, though, around the world have been killed one way or another. I mentioned there was at least one guy who was killed in a hit-and-run. It seems like there's a pattern of people who are involved with finances who are dying mysteriously. And I also mentioned on last week's show a lot of people who are involved with UFOs and UFO research are apparently dying mysteriously. In fact, our friend Nick Redfern has written a book about this pattern of deaths, which we'll be talking to him about in the near future. So here we have a lot of different dynamics that are taking place at once. We have bankers that are dying. We have UFO researchers that are dying at the very same time that this financial transition is happening in the world, which is incorporating gold once again. And this takes us back to a deeper exploration of why it is that gold has always been such an important standard of currency for civilization. I mean, going back to the earliest recordings of civilized society. And, you know, when I was writing my book, The Secret Wisdom of Kukulcan, which I believe came out in 2009, I spent a good deal of time looking into exactly why it is that gold was ever considered such a special element, so to speak. You know, why was that the one thing universally in cultures around the world that was celebrated, not only for economics, but also for sacred and religious purposes. I mean, this was what people would adorn themselves with. It was also what was used for some of the almost supernatural devices that are associated with communication beyond. The best example of that is probably the Ark of the Covenant, which we'll talk about a little bit later, where, you know, if you read the details of the Bible, it's stated very specifically how the Ark of the Covenant was to be created, and it was to be layered inside and out with gold. So what I want to do is discuss a little bit about why it is that gold may have once been that fundamental key element that took humans from the age of hunter-gatherers into the age of emperors, pharaohs, monarchs, people who were in such positions of power. We can scarcely imagine the reign that they had over the others in their society, enough to build amazing kingdoms. I mean, if you look at, say, the Great Pyramids, for example, there are lots of, theories about how they were built. I recently watched a fascinating documentary online in which a guy made a very good case for the fact that the pyramids may have been constructed by creating what amounts to water channels that would run up and down the side of the structure as it was being created, so that instead of having to manually lift these large blocks and defy gravity, the blocks may have been stuck into a water channel and floated up to the point where they needed to be, and then floated over and put into place.
Well, there is evidence that water was there at one time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And not just water, but also channels of water. And these would have been, to some extent, temporary channels of water, long enough to help them move these blocks, and then those were removed afterward. Point is, if you've got pretty much unlimited wealth based upon gold and whatever that bought you in terms of ruling people, and you've got all the slaves that you can ever ask for, you can accomplish some pretty darn incredible stuff. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about why I think gold became that fundamental standard of wealth and power for early civilization, and how it relates to the visitors that came here. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to the show where the unusual becomes usual. Stick around for more on Speaking of Strange.
You don't remember. You got a golden hand. Super bad. You don't remember. You don't.
Strange. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren. Fittingly enough, tonight's program, presented by Wright's Coin Shop. You can call Shelley Wright there and ask her all about gold and silver at 828-298-5402. Again, Wright's Coin Shop, 828-298-5402. And before we jump back into this discussion of the mystery of gold, let me also point out that, of course, recently the movie Alien Abduction, based on the Brown Mountain Lights, had a huge world premiere in Morganton, North Carolina. It was a gigantic success. There were two theaters that both sold out. They had a red carpet rolled out. All the media were there. The director, producers, stars were there. It's making headlines all over the place. And, of course, this weekend, the movie is now open in various cities around the country. And if you are curious about the Brown Mountain Lights, you know, I recently wrote an official booklet called Brown Mountain Lights, a viewing guide. And if you would like to read this, and it's a nice full-color publication, you can do so for free. Go to joshuapwarren.com to find a PDF of the booklet. Again, that's joshuapwarren.com. There's no period after the P. And you'll even find inside there a photograph of an alien, so they say, that was at Brown Mountain. So take advantage of that while you can read it for free. Let's get back to our discussion here, because, goodness, there's a lot of content. I was talking about the connection that gold may have to the visitors that came here thousands of years ago. And by visitors, I mean those beings that inspired all of the numerous religions and philosophies and belief systems on this planet thousands of years ago. Whatever was happening, people in countries all around the world claimed that there were beings that came, that often descended from the sky and interacted with humankind. And I have referred to these advanced beings as paratemporals, meaning that they operate outside of the traditional boundaries of space-time that you and I seem to be locked within. To explain how that sort of connects with gold, I think it's going to be easiest to just read to you part of The Secret Wisdom of Kukulcan, in which I spell all of this out. Here we go. When they came a few thousand years ago, these advanced paratemporal entities saw some great value in our crude lives, and they battled over it with the same political fervor we engage in today. What did they want from us? They wanted a number of things. Why do we humans fight and try to conquer other lands? When a child asks you, why did we go to Vietnam, what is your answer? The quest to take property and dominate others can be explained in many ways, depending on the point of view. But there are always many reasons. One of the things paratemporals wanted was gold. Beyond mere bartering, the basis of true human currency was exchange of gold. But why have we always considered it so valuable? Of all the substances in our realm, the paratemporals especially wanted the gold. It could be because gold is an excellent electrical conductor that resists corrosion, essential for some of their vehicles and machines. Or it could have been for protection. Even today, our astronauts use gold linings in helmets and suits to guard against harmful infrared waves. Gold is so good at reflecting infrared and radio waves that we also use coatings of it on some satellites orbiting in space. Plus, gold is so malleable that a single ounce can be beaten into a sheet of 300 square feet, thin enough to be translucent, yet it remains intact. No traditional historian knows exactly why people have always valued gold so much, and usually says, mainly because it's pretty. But there was something much more. Humans evolved in Africa, where we have found the earliest human remains. The first wave of paratemporals that wanted gold encountered humans there, around Babylonia, the cradle of civilization. In his book, Rule by Secrecy, Jim Mars explores the agenda of paratemporals. The particular sect he writes about is the Anunnaki, first explored in depth by Zechariah Sitchin. Regarding the question of why the Anunnaki may have wanted gold, Marr saw fit to quote author Lloyd Pye, who in his book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, wrote, quote, "The Anunnaki sought gold to save their atmosphere, which had apparently sprung leaks similar to those we have created in ours by damaging the Earth's ozone layer. The Anunnaki solution was to disperse extremely tiny flakes of gold into their upper atmosphere to patch holes. Modern scientists contend that if we are ever forced to repair our own damaged ozone layer, tiny particles of gold shot into the upper atmosphere would be the best way to go about it," end quote. Regardless of exactly why the paratemporals wanted to use humans as slaves to mine and shape gold, they did want to use humans to mine and shape gold. In the same way, our modern scientists play with genes, making glow-in-the-dark monkeys or putting an ear on a mouse's back, the visitors played with our genes. The ultimate goal was to make a hybrid of ancient man and themselves. They wanted a primate with enough strength to work the earth and enough intelligence to properly handle the complex processes of purifying gold. Hunched, hairy humans changed into something more advanced, made more in the image of the paratemporals, skipping natural stages of evolution by leaps and bounds. As Genesis says, quote, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness," end quote. The modern human served a great purpose for the paratemporals. We were very effective slaves, and to our dominated ancestors, the visitors were truly gods. When the Spaniards invaded the New World in the 1500s, natives believed the Spanish were immortal. In Puerto Rico, a Taino Indian chief and some followers drowned a Spaniard and watched the corpse for 3 days to see if it would spring back to life. If the sight of an armored, bearded white man from a seafaring ship made such an impression hundreds of years ago, can you imagine how our early modern humans viewed these paratemporals? The visitors were very well aware of how to herd creatures like humans. They picked certain people as liaisons, individuals with whom they would communicate directly. Those people, perhaps like Moses or Muhammad, would relay messages to larger groups and have been heralded as prophets and leaders. Because the gods were associated with gold, idols of gold were often made by cults of humans, and the people were torn over time as competing divisions of paratemporals battled with each other over the resources of Earth. Each paratemporal considered himself God and his competition the devil. As always, self-interest, the need to be worshipped and obeyed, was paramount to each one of the visitors. There were some rogue paratemporals who adopted lives with the humans, even interbreeding with them directly. Many Bible scholars might think of those who assimilated into human culture and tampered with our genes as the Nephilim. They were considered beings of low caliber by their peers. Most of the paratemporals deemed their behavior unnatural and unbecoming. They condemned it, or at very least, did not condone it. Now, again, that's a passage from my book, The Secret Wisdom of Kukulcan. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to read a little bit to you to refresh you about the Ark of the Covenant, and then how all this leads to a groundbreaking new discovery by scientists that helps to put an even deeper spin on how these paratemporals, these visitors, may have functioned then and how that we are coming into contact with them again now. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to the show where the unusual becomes usual. This is Speaking of Strange. Speaking of Strange, I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren. The program is brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop. And, you know, the fact that we're talking about gold has nothing to do with the fact that the show is presented by Wright's Coin Shop. It's a convenient connection. But this is actually the anniversary of the order which outlawed possession of most gold by U.S. citizens 81 years ago. And so we're digging into the mystery of gold. But it's a very good time to purchase yourself some gold. Call up Wright's Coin Shop, and you can get started with a very small amount of money if you want to get some silver and possibly some gold. 828-298-5402. 828-298-5402. Talk to Shelley Wright. You know, when you dig into the realms of gold enigmas, you can't help but realize the significant role that it played in the power and the sort of religious beliefs of ancient peoples. You have a scenario where obviously rulers were obsessed with gold. I mean, look what they found in King Tut's tomb. But also, the world of the spiritual and the religious is chock full of references to the power of gold. The best example of this is, of course, the Ark of the Covenant. In the Old Testament, I mean, the Ark of the Covenant was the most powerful and precious possession of the Israelites. They carried the Ark with them everywhere, and it had powers that we still have difficulty defining. But let me first say the book of Exodus gives very detailed instructions on how the ark was to be constructed. It was to be 2.5 cubits in length, 1.5 in breadth, 1.5 in height, then to be plated entirely with gold, and a crown or molding of gold to be put around it, 4 rings of gold to be attached to its 4 feet, 2 on each side. And through these rings, staves of wood overlaid with gold for carrying the ark were to be inserted and not removed. A golden cover was to be put on it, adorned with a golden cherubim. The ark was to be placed behind a veil. Okay, so this is all from Exodus. And here are some other quotes about the Ark of the Covenant. This is Hebrews 9:4. Having the golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden urn holding the manna, and Aaron's staff that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. So the manna that was inside the Ark, which was a direct representation of God sending this miraculous substance down to sustain life, should be placed in a golden urn. All right? Exodus 25:22 says, God apparently is speaking to the people, there I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are on the ark of the testimony, I will speak with you about all that I will give you in commandment for the people of Israel. This is where God is claiming that the area between those two golden cherubim is the portal, the communication point, where you can literally talk to God, okay? This is the transmitter that you may remember from Raiders of the Lost Ark. They talked about this being a device to speak to God. It's between the golden cherubim. And in Revelation 11:19, it says, then God's temple in heaven was opened, and the ark of his covenant was seen within his temple. There were flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and heavy hail. You know, the Ark of the Covenant was able to levitate. It was able to shoot forth unimaginable power that would play a major role in leveling whole cities. what is it about this ark being the most powerful representation of their belief and gold? Again, it may be because gold even has some property that we still don't understand, that still may be beyond human conception. And a part of that has to do with us changing the way that we visualize how communication with the paratemporals, with these extra-dimensional or interdimensional beings, occurs. Now, if you think of, say, something like the Ark of the Covenant being a radio that will communicate with God, that's actually a very crude way of visualizing what's happening here. And I mentioned earlier in the program that for years now, the SETI program has been trying to intercept alien communication or alien life via radio signals. So they have these gigantic radio telescopes set up around, and they're sitting there waiting to receive some type of a wave that might be produced by an alien civilization. The problem, however, is that if an alien or extra-dimensional civilization is advanced enough to manipulate space and time and matter in order to come here and do these amazing and miraculous things, why should we think they are using a technology that humans have been using for over 100 years now? Bearing that in mind, here is a new report that has come out, which is quite exciting and mind-boggling. It is about a new experiment that was done at the University of Waterloo in Canada. And this experiment has opened the door to multi-party quantum communication. Now, let me try to explain to you first sort of what this means before I dig into the story. Whenever we think about something like a radio transmission, you have one antenna, which is a transmitter, and another antenna, which is a receiver. And the one that is transmitting shoots out this wave of electromagnetic energy, and that wave travels linearly across distances, across space and time, until it finally hits the receiving antenna. And that's why when we are looking at the cosmos, we are supposedly picking up transmissions which may have originated millions or billions of years ago. And it's taken them that long to travel across the vastness of space and to reach us. But there is this other concept which is fundamental to quantum physics, which Einstein called spooky action at a distance. And this is the property scientists discovered between two particles in space, whereas one particle seems to be entangled with another particle. Now, what that means is that there is some kind of a connection between these two particles, so that when one moves, the other one moves instantaneously, regardless of the distance between them. Now, we don't understand exactly how that works, but guess what? That has now advanced to a whole new, profound level. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to tell you about that new, profound level, because, mind you, we are moving our way of thinking about all this from a linear transmission from point A to point B to an instantaneous connection between one point and another. Doesn't matter if they're on opposite sides of a room or opposite sides of the universe. If one point is able to communicate directly with another point, there is no measurable transmission that takes place between the two. So you can set up all the radio antennas you want in between, and you're not going to get anything. Now, that is special enough. This new experiment, however, has taken it to the next level, because it has demonstrated that this not only works with two points in space, but with multiple points in space. Start trying to wrap your head around that, and I'll explain more when we return. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the show where the unusual becomes usual, presented by Wright's Coin Shop in Asheville, North Carolina. You are listening to Speaking of Strange.
Gold finger, he's the man with a mind. A cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin. But don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you feel. Kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold.
And we're in the final minutes of hour number two on tonight's Speaking of Strange. Next hour, well, we call it the Dark 30 Hour. That's when we dig into the more outrageous and controversial stuff, not for the kiddies, not for the easily offended, so you can determine whether or not you want to stay tuned in for that last hour of the show, we say, for late at night, when we dig into some of the more sordid and seedy stuff. I am Joshua P. Warren, and, gosh, it's amazing how this hour has flown by, considering how much there has been to discuss. And don't forget, if you want to go to Wright's Coin Shop, check out their website, wrightscoinshop.com. There is a link at speakingofstrange.com. So try to wrap your head around this. For the first time, physicists at the Institute for Quantum Computing at the University of Waterloo have demonstrated the distribution of three entangled photons at three different locations. Several hundreds of meters apart, proving quantum non-locality for more than two entangled photons. Now, let me try to explain in my own words best I can why this is so profound. As I mentioned before the break, if we know that one particle in space can instantly communicate with another particle in space, regardless of distance, without interfering with anything in between, it shows us that potentially every point in space can be connected to another point in space by some means that are unclear to us. But if we now expand that to say that three points in space can all be connected to each other, well, from there, we can predict that there is no limit on how many points in space can all be entangled. And if we are talking about a worldview, a universe view, that allows an almost infinite number of points in space to interact with each other instantaneously and communicate with each other, the internet of the future is going to operate this way. So instead of the internet being based upon transmission of electromagnetic information going through cable wires or DSL wires or satellite signals, all these things that are based upon linear transmissions, we are going to evolve to a point where the internet will be points in space that are directly communicating with each other without a transmission in between being necessary. And when you begin extrapolating from that, and you consider that we are going to have an internet that is able to take advantage of all of the different points in space-time instantly communicating, that sort of overlays into a model that you can think of as a holographic universe, i.e., the reality that you and I are walking around in every single day. If your mind is exploding right now, I understand, because what I'm ultimately saying is that it's possible that the internet is a sort of crude demonstration of what all of reality actually is. The internet operates on only a couple of planes. You take from that the idea that an internet structure can operate in all dimensions, not just the three that we're in, not just the four that we're in, but possibly the 11 or 12 or who knows how many thousands or millions of dimensions there may be. Once we are able to tap into that, we are going to see very clearly how the information may be instantaneously transferred from one point in space to another. And by transferring information, we're able to change the medium. So, long story short, if these beings that are coming here from another place are doing so with this advanced type of technology, that explains why we're not going to be picking up much from them in terms of these old crude radio signals and transmissions that humans are looking for. Instead, they are using something tapping into the very fabric of space-time. And we are going to gradually learn about that. It's going to be revealed to us as we explore it, first through the next level of an internet medium, until we eventually realize all of reality is like a big, complex internet. And therefore, when we understand how to manipulate that, we'll be able to travel through it just like they can. And we also will be able to tap into it, to hack it, to morph it, to shape it into whatever we want it to be, just like you're building your own little web page. Okay. Let's take a break. Let that sink in. When we come back, we've taken you to the summit of mankind's enlightenment. Now we're about to dive into the pit of his depravity. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking Truth. 13-month-old baby, you broke the looking glass.